Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi there, welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about Oswald Mosley, who, as most of you probably know, was the leader of the British Union of Fascists during the 1930s. Now, I think there are many reasons to talk about Mosley, but particularly the one that's most important, I think, is his lack of ultimate success. One of the questions I think that it's worth evaluating is why Britain had neither a lurch towards the left or the right in terms of extremes during the 1930s, and what it was about Britain that managed to kind of insulate it from the prevailing trends really towards extremism on the continent. One only has to look at Germany, Spain, Italy and the Soviet Union for some good examples. But it was hardly the case that there were benign liberal democracies in Poland, Hungary, Romania, or any of the Balkan states. Far from it. The continent was largely undemocratic during the 1930s. And in countries that were democratic, notably France, there was a far more lively fascist movement. And one that during World War II obviously manifests itself eventually as aspects of the Vichy regime. So let's talk a little bit about who Mosley was and where he was from, and a little bit about him as a man. Mosley was the son of a baronet. He was an Anglo-Irish aristocrat. He was born in 1896. He was married into the Curzon family in 1920. After the First World War, a man such as Mosley, tall, handsome, intelligent, dynamic, and most importantly, alive, was a hell of a catch. And he was really the toast of post-war London and the eye of every debutante. He was quite keen on ingratiating himself with his politically powerful new family. And he had come from a line of the Mosley family that had really run out of cash. He had huge aristocratic claims, but not really an awful lot of money to back it up with, and had grown up in relatively, for the British aristocracy, relatively humble circumstances. And I detect from a couple of readings I have of Mosley that part of his resentment towards the establishment came from this. Of course, Mosley was a veteran of the First World War, as were so many of the advocates of fascism throughout the war. Mosley had quite a checkered war record. He was injured out of his role in the Lancers, and he joined the Royal Flying Corps as an observer. The Royal Flying Corps being a very exciting and experimental branch of the army, as it was at that stage, and one which was seen as quite glamorous and dashing, and the kind of thing that befitted Mosley's immense ego. He injured himself in a crash and wound up with a desk job for the rest of the war, and was incredibly lucky, really, to survive the war in the way that he did. And during the election of 1918, Mosley stands for Parliament, only aged 21. and not a man who'd really developed a kind of a key set of ideological positions. He stands for the Conservatives, but really on a platform of avoiding future war. And this is obviously an immensely popular idea, and it's one that shapes post-war Britain, or interwar Britain, should I say, really up until 1938-39. He soon fell out of favour with the Conservatives, or they fell out of favour with him. With his Irish roots, he was particularly opposed to the brutality with which the Liberal-led coalition government, supported by the Conservatives, suppressed the IRA in Ireland, the use of black and tans, who were violent, demobbed paramilitary troops designed to use to fight terror with terror during the War of Independence in Ireland, appalled Mosley, and he crossed the floor and joined the Labour Party in opposition. He started out life as an independent MP once he left the government, and finally actually fully joins the Labour Party in 1924, just in time for Ramsay MacDonald's first Labour administration. Mosley lost his seat for 2 years, between 24 and 26, following the fall of the first Labour government, and during that time some of his economic ideas begin to take shape, and these are influenced by changes on the continent that he's observing, particularly economic changes happening in Italy. His next foray back into national politics is with the Labour government that's returned to power in 1929, just as the economic crisis that's engulfing the world manages to have a profound effect on Britain. And the impression that one gets of Mosley throughout much of his political career, but particularly when he's in office, is one of immense impatience. He's a very young politician still, but one who's immensely egotistical, who believes really that he has the answers, that he is some great figure that can lead the nation, and that his ideas must be listened to. He's very unhappy about being sidelined almost immediately that MacDonald wins office again. And he winds up as the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which is an empty portfolio. He's given the role of dealing with the unemployment problem, which is seen before the Wall Street crash as something of a backwater. And some of the ideas that Mosley puts forward may well have actually worked. They seem to be, on paper, potentially quite dynamic ideas, but alarming ideas, particularly to the Labour Party. The Labour Party, in its first few administrations, was far more keen on proving to a hostile, largely right-wing press and a unsure electorate, particularly a middle-class electorate, that it wasn't radical, that it didn't pose a radical threat to property or wealth, and that it wasn't kind of a hidden Bolshevism. So the hot-headed ideas of Mosley, which I'll go into in a moment, were really not very well received by the government at all. There's a lot about Mosley that is rather reminiscent of Joseph Chamberlain, an entire generation before him. And he put forward the Mosley Memorandum, which demanded that there should be tariffs, much as Chamberlain had done up until 1907. There should be tariffs for protection, to make sure that British industry could compete with international competition, particularly from the USA. And he was particularly keen on nationalisation. Now, this is something that the MacDonald governments, because they've been minority governments, had never been able to do. But looking at fascist Italy had, in effect, nationalised huge chunks of state industry, of national industries. There was a great deal of Keynesianism in the Mosley Memorandum. If you'd listened previously to the podcast on Hayek, I'm going to do something on Keynes in the future. The two were really kind of poles apart. Keynes was very much about, Keynes' famous dictum was that one should give a man a meaningless job for the day if he's unemployed. Ask him to dig a hole and fill it in again at the end of the day, because ultimately, when you pay him, he'll go and spend the money in his shop and it will start the kind of the flow of money into the economy once more. And Mosley was all about this. He believed that public works were the way to solve unemployment, and that if one did this kind of thing, you could really inject some moral fibre back into the unemployed, because there was obviously something kind of unemployment had atrophied their spirit in some way. So these ideas are thrown out. Nobody wants to hear them. And Mosley resigns from his ministerial role. His egotism and his anger towards the government and his incomprehension at their inability to take in what he views as essential action, it suggests that Mosley wasn't a particularly seasoned political player. He wasn't particularly savvy to the workings of Westminster. One only needs to contrast the Mosley memorandum with what the Labour government was actually doing at the time, which was really looking to the international financial system, to the City of London and to Wall Street, and attempting to craft policies that would appeal to them. One obviously being the huge cut in welfare, and later on in the 1930s and 1934, the introduction of a means testing for benefits. And this was, in Mosley's view, rank hypocrisy and deeply unpatriotic. Following his resignation, Mosley founds the New Party in 1931. And the New Party isn't quite the British Union of Fascists yet. It is on a journey, really, to fascism. Initially, it has some interesting supporters. Both Aneurin Bevin and Harold Macmillan are supporters of the New Party Manifesto, which gives you a suggestion that really it starts out as being something not acutely undemocratic. The economic basis of the New Party is corporatism. Corporatism was the economic bedrock of fascist Italy. Corporatism is really state direction, not only of industry, but of the trade unions as well, and ensuring that the two were answerable and agreeable to one another and to the state, and that the state unions and industry work in... I mean, this is the ideal, it doesn't actually work like this in Italy, but work in a kind of a partnership where industrial, economic and ideological disputes are suppressed in favour of the national interest, and the national interest is the thing that is upheld above all. By 1932, however, the New Party has moved directly towards supporting fascism. And during 1932, Mosley actually unites all the disparate fascist, anti-Semitic and various sort of extreme right-wing parties within Britain, which created, there's a whole tapestry of different small extremist groups that exist across the country, some who have an agenda closer to Italian fascism, some that look to create a kind of a more authentic British nationalism based around the empire. And these range from the reasonably serious political contenders on the far right to all manner of...
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Extremists on the margins of things and, you know, various crackpots and that kind of thing. Before the end of the new party, which is ultimately dissolved to form with all these other fringe organisations, the British Union of Fascists, before the BUF, Mosley already had a paramilitary-type organisation. The Black Shirts hadn't emerged yet, but he had a kind of a gang of toughs, referred to as the Biff Boys, who helped police his meetings and speeches and made sure that socialist troublemakers and all sorts of other undesirables didn't disrupt what Mosley was trying to do. One of the people who was attracted to Mosley was the fascist William Joyce, again a veteran from the First World War and a man whose anti-communism, anti-Semitism and extraordinary resentment towards the British establishment, and again he was an Anglo-Irish kind of outsider, potentially it was Joyce, I believe, who perhaps drew Mosley further to the extremes. Not that this is in any way a justification or vindication or sympathy for Mosley himself. He was quite, man's quite aware of what he was doing. But his real kind of ideological Nazi at his side was William Joyce, who later, of course, goes on to be known as Lord Haw Haw. Joyce fled to Germany before the outbreak of the Second World War and gave broadcasts from Germany throughout the war, undermining the British war effort. His shtick was this character, Lord Haw Haw, where he pretended to be some kind of Bertie Wooster-style aristocrat to make fun of the British upper classes, and he was arrested and executed at the end of the war. Another key collaborator with Joyce was a guy called John Beckett, whose son Francis Beckett writes some brilliant history books. If you ever get a chance, read his book Marching Towards the Fault Line, which is his history of the miners' strike. The other enthusiast initially for the British Union of Fascists was Lord Rothermere, the owner of the Daily Mail. And the Daily Mail was the newspaper who led on the immortal headline, Hurrah for the Black Shirts. And Rothermere wasn't an anti-Semite. He wasn't a Nazi in any way. His main interest really was that of anti-communism. And he believed that Britain faced a threat from communism. And the Black Shirts were really the boys for the job who would stop the communists. And certainly the Black Shirts were engaged in all sorts of venues across the country, in Manchester, in Aberdeen, in London, in particularly Eastern London, in pitched fights at communist meetings and communist infiltrated Black Shirt meetings. At the height of the violence between the two, came at Mosley's one major attempt to have a kind of a breakthrough moment on the national political scene, which was his rally at the Kensington Olympia in 1934. The rally was infiltrated by Communist Party members along with anti-fascist activists who were come from a variety of political and ethnic backgrounds, and they protested loudly, shouted down Mosley as he spoke, and they were forcibly ejected and beaten and attacked by the Black Shirt stewards who were there. The movement shifts very from about 1933 onwards, shifts very far, very quickly in the direction of anti-Semitism. And it's no coincidence that once fascism itself becomes ensconced in anti-Semitism on the continent, where Hitler's star as the leader of European fascism and extreme right-wing politics is in the ascendancy and Mussolini's is in the decline after 1933, the nature of British fascism shifts away from its kind of Italian model towards its a more Germanic Nazi model. One of the things that is generally true about Italian fascism, whilst Mussolini had certain anti-Semitic views, certainly he didn't really incorporate anti-Semitism into Italian fascism until 1938, when a deal with Germany looked on the cards, and Mussolini had decided that alliances with Western democracies were going to be something of a waste of time. So there is this key shift towards anti-Semitism. Mosley seems to embrace anti-Semitism more and more, and he seems to, in this period, whether this is real or whether this is simply an attempt to curry favour with Hitler, I'm not sure, but he seems to embrace a hatred of the Jews, or the Jews as an explanation for the nation's ills. And unfortunately for Mosley, it is the rise of Hitler and the fear of a second European war that Hitler represents to the British population that really pours cold water on his future ambitions. The bottom falls out of Mosley's support between 1933 and 1934. When the first news of repression in Nazi Germany starts to reach the British press, the population becomes not necessarily overwhelmingly warlike towards Nazi Germany, but certainly the appeal of anything that resembles a German kind of politics in the eyes of most ordinary people becomes very unfavourable indeed. And the movement is pretty much broken in 1936, when Mosley tries a provocative march through the East End of London, where the bulk of Britain's Jewish population lives. Most of these people are emigres from Tsarist Russia, or the descendants of emigres from Tsarist Russia from about the 1880s onwards, and there is a lively anti-fascist tradition within the East End of London, and he is confronted at Cable Street. The figures go something like this, that Mosley marched down Cable Street with 5,000 black shirt supporters and was met with 100,000 anti-fascists. The police, whom, if you read documentary accounts of what happened on that day at Cable Street, seem to have been unusually sympathetic towards the fascists, ended the march, and Sir Philip Game, the Chief Commissioner for London Police, prevented the march from going ahead. Government action came quickly after that, with the Public Order Act, which banned the British Union of Fascists from wearing their uniforms, and meant that any marches in the future would have to be regulated and there would have to be official permission given. Mosley, in the years before the war, puts most of his efforts into largely ineffective appeasement-style politics, staying out of Germany's business and that kind of thing. He is interned during the war, and afterwards his return to form involves the formation of a new fascist movement. He called it the Union Movement. It was in part a rejection of mass immigration after the war from the Caribbean and from Southeast Asia, Southern Asia, sorry. But also he thought that there should be some kind of union of European nations under, obviously, some kind of overall fascist ideal, which would reject not only the threat of Soviet communism, but also the influence that the United States was inevitably going to have in Europe from the end of 1945 onwards, really up until 1989. And it was an attempt to kind of fend off these two unwelcome forms, whatever he viewed, of a kind of non-European modernity that he wanted to ring-fence Europe from. And he also felt that countries like France and Britain and Belgium could pull the last of their colonies and hang on to them. That there was no reason to give it places like Kenya or the Belgian Congo, that everyone could cooperate. And I suppose what he was envisaging was a kind of sort of fascist-style European Union with a European empire tagged on. But this was not to be. It's worth bearing in mind at this point that Mosley is a completely discredited, marginal figure, something of a national pariah, having picked the wrong side during the war, and given that, you know, 60,000 people, civilians alone, were killed in German bombing during the war. Somebody who shook hands with Hitler and Hitler officiated at his wedding. It's really not a very popular figure at all. He died in 1980, but he continued contesting parliamentary seats until the late 1960s. One of his admirers is the well-known fascist and, in gigantic inverted commas, historian David Irving, who was there when Mosley, in the mid-60s, was giving speeches against Commonwealth immigration. During the heyday of Mosley's career, he never realistically came anywhere near destabilising the government. For various reasons, possibly because Britain hadn't lost the First World War, we didn't have the legacy of, a German-imposed Treaty of Versailles or a loss of the Empire. Britain, yes, of course, goes through economic ups and downs during the war, but it's nothing really compared to those faced by Italy and Germany after World War One. And the hold that fascism had over the British public, you know, it's not to be completely sniffed at. At one point, and this is, you know, this is quoting BUF figures, however, at one point supposedly there were some 50,000 members. So they did pose some kind of threat to internal order. But perhaps it is, you know, Britain's long tradition of parliamentary democracy and long tradition of transition since the Civil War back in the 17th century. That means that our parliamentary democracy is capable of absorbing these kinds of shocks, whereas perhaps the parliamentary system within Germany wasn't. Anyway, I hope that's useful, and you can catch me on the next podcast. We're going to be talking a little bit more about Russia later this week, and we are just shy of the 10,000 mark. So, by the way, if you enjoy this podcast, you could do me an immense, immense favour. It'll take you 2 minutes of your time. If you can go to the iTunes podcast page for Explaining History, and I think there's a tab there that gives reviews, write-ups, that kind of thing, plaudits and praise. Please, please go there, hit us up with some praise, and we can then really plough on and give you lots more quality podcasts. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. I look forward to speaking to you all soon. All the best. Have a great 1st of September. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.